Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. On Sunday, millions of people across the country celebrated Earth Day by bringing attention to plastic pollution, calling for clean air, water, and land, planting trees, organizing educational and cleanup events, and promoting and supporting environmental sustainability. One issue that is finally getting more attention is the impact of industrial factory farming on our environment and climate change. Also, the role our food production system and dietary habits have on greenhouse gas emissions. Our food system contributes about 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions, more than any other sector except energy production. In their new book, Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. Today's guests, Neil Zacharias and Jean Stone, write, industrial animal agriculture is at the heart of the biggest problem of our time, our environmental crisis. 99% of meat, dairy, and eggs available in the U.S. come from industrial animal agriculture or from factory farms. By eating those foods, you're doing as much, if not more, harm to the environment as if you didn't recycle, take a plane, drive your car, or find a way to make your dog your ecological statement. By the year 2050, the world must feed 9.8 billion people. And to achieve that, we need to produce more food in the next 40 years than was produced in the past 10,000 years. So how can we help heal our planet one bite at a time? Jean Stone is an acclaimed author who has written more than 45 books on a wide variety of subjects and co-authored national bestsellers such as Forks Over Knives and How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reduce Disease. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. Neil Zacharias is co-founder of One Green Planet, an online platform focused on sustainable food, animal welfare issues, and environmental protection. And he joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Neil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Jean Stone and Neil Zacharias are co-authors of Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. Well, Neil, this is your first book. Jean, you're very busy. This is your 46th book. It's a small book. It's a very quick read, full of great graphics and a lot of statistics about how our animal-based diet has contributed to climate change and why we really need to think differently about why we eat. Neil, how did you come up with the idea for this book?
So we've been thinking and talking about this issue on One Green Planet for a few years now. I sort of stumbled upon the connection between factory farming and the environment by traveling to South America, eating a lot of beef, and learning more about the connection between the food that I was eating and the environmental destruction that was happening in the rainforests of the Amazon. And that kind of led me into investigating further into the issue. And over the years, we felt that there wasn't enough media attention to the topic of how our food impacts the environment, and people weren't talking so much about the simple solutions that exist out there. So our goal with the book right from the beginning was, how can we take something that is traditionally pretty dry, very heavy in terms of scientific research, and distill that into something that will be small, effective, graphic heavy, and that can reach the most amount of people, especially young people who don't read as many books as they should, and probably have less of an attention span than others. So the book was designed to do that.
Well, I am hoping that we can get to as many facts as possible. And since you brought up the Amazon and deforestation, let's just talk about this. In your book, you write that in the past 40 years, almost 20% of the Amazon rainforest has been destroyed, with more trees being cut down than in the 450 years following the start of European colonization. In the Brazilian region of the Amazon, 80 million cattle roam on land that was once untouched rainforest. And in this region, about 80% of deforestation is caused by cattle ranching. I mean, these numbers are massive, and for some people, it's hard to wrap your head around it. We've seen a lot of photos of deforestation. But Neil, since this was a fairly new issue for you, after doing all of this research, what did you learn about deforestation and especially in the Amazon?
So about 80%, as you said, 80% of deforestation in the Amazon has been connected or tied into cattle ranching in some ways. So either you're clearing rainforests to grow feed for cows, which is usually soy or corn, or it is used to graze cattle. So as I started looking deeper into the issue, I realized that this is a bigger problem than we previously have thought about, is because firstly, the rainforests are our carbon sinks. If we don't have the rainforests, we lose one of the greatest sort of safeguards we have against climate change, against rising greenhouse gas emissions. And the problem with clearing rainforests to make more room to grow food, to feed the food that we then end up eating, you end up decimating one of the important, as I said, carbon sinks of the planet, but you also end up releasing the stored carbon in those rainforests back into the atmosphere. So not only are we cutting down our defenses, we are actually further contributing to greenhouse gases in the environment. And then not to mention, as you clear the rainforest, you're impacting all the species that are that use those rainforests as their home and their natural habitat, and all the surrounding communities that depend on those forests for food and other kinds of agricultural commodities. So the deeper I looked into the issue, the thing I realized is that you can look at the Amazon rainforest and you can look at deforestation, and there's a book's worth of material in that topic in itself. But the bigger thing that seemed to be missing in the discussion around food in the environment is how all these issues are interconnected with each other. And that's what we hope to bring out with this book, which was, you can look at Amazon rainforest and you can look at deforestation, but if you start connecting the dots between that, between climate change, between extreme weather, ocean acidification, you end up with this pretty fascinating web of connections that all lead to one conclusion, is that when we are nearly 10 billion people on this planet by 2050, we're going to have a really hard time feeding our population without destroying the life support systems on our planet that we depend upon.
I mean, especially as we have this globalized food system. Gene Stone, you have written a number of books about these issues, Forks Over Knives, How Not to Die. Why did you decide to take on a project of this really nice short book that's full of graphics and so many really daunting facts?
There are a lot of daunting facts, and we hope we don't scare anybody off with all of them. And as we pointed out, that's why the book is rather short. In my case, I've been a plant-based whole food eater for maybe about a dozen years or so, and I've written extensively on issues of animal protection and issues of health relating to a plant-based diet. But what I noticed is a lot of the kids I was talking to, and by kids, by the way, I mean anyone younger than me, anybody who was coming into the movement, they were interested in the effect of a plant-based diet on the environment. And so this whole sort of veganism movement, if you will, was basically predicated on these three pillars, but there wasn't a popular book yet on the subject of the relationship of a plant-based diet and the environment. So given that I'd written a lot on these other two areas, I really wanted to expand the subject matter. And it was Neil is actually somebody I met when I gave a publishing party for Dr. Michael Greger, and Neil came, and we started talking, and we discovered that both of us had been thinking about exactly this subject, that so many people are interested in a plant-based diet, and they don't realize that, yeah, it's great for health, and yeah, it's terrific for the animals, but it's actually really, really good for the earth, and we need to get that message out.
Well, let's talk about some of these facts, because when you sit back and think about where we are today, especially when you look at the population, we've done a lot of shows about population. You write that it took 200,000 years for the human population to reach 1 billion, okay? 200,000 years for the human population to reach 1 billion. So let's let that sink in for a minute. And only 200 more years to swell to 7.5 billion. And then, as you point out, By the year 2050, we're expected to have about 10 billion people on this planet. And to achieve that, we will need to produce more food in the next 40 years than was produced in the past 10,000 years. Now, Gene, we've also done a lot of shows about our food system. And so many food justice advocates say that right now things are very backwards. If we changed the food system today, we would have enough food to feed all of these people, but we don't because of so many issues, monopolies, big ag, what have you. So when you think about population growth and what we are about to face with 10 billion people, what really stood out for you, Gene, in the research that you did?
Well, just very bluntly, it can't go on like this. I mean, it just simply can't. 40% of our world's grain is being fed to livestock. We have maybe a billion people going to bed hungry every night. The relationship between ag industry and the population growth is ridiculous. I think if you read the book, Eve of the Planet, and you think about it, you can't help but agree. But getting people to understand that, as you pointed out in the very beginning, there are a lot of facts in here, and that's because there are so many facts that justify cutting back on animal agriculture. How do you get people to understand that? And that's what we're up against, and that's why we're grateful to you for having us on. But it's really not easy. It isn't easy at all to get people to understand. They're saying, you mean I can't have my hamburger? You mean I can't have my eggs? And then when you say, well, look at the effect on the food system, look at population growth, it's very hard for people to make that jump from their meal to the world.
Mm. And when you look at demand for meat, dairy, and eggs around the globe, I mean, we are seeing major spikes in places like China, India, some places in South America. I was just watching a Vice video about how fast food American companies are all over Kuwait. There's a massive demand there for fast food. Neil, can you talk a little bit about that, just how the demand for this food is really changing around the world?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think a lot about because I actually grew up in India and I grew up eating meat. And one thing I did notice growing up is people around me weren't eating meat to the extent that they are now. So I was back in Bombay this past December and spending time over there and talking to people over there, and just basically partly on my observations, but also in terms of what's happening in the country with the rising middle class in India and countries like India and China. Mm-hmm. You have now people turning to a more meat-centric diet as a way to sustain themselves. And it is the complete opposite of what should be happening, where, in fact, over here in America, we're talking about how we need to shift away from industrialized agriculture. The developing world is going the opposite direction, and that's actually even more dangerous because the majority of the world's population is in China and India, and that's where all the growth is also coming from. So as these economies start to rise, we're going to see China and India make the same mistakes that we've made, but the scale and the impact of those mistakes are going to be significantly higher. And to kind of connect that to the previous point you brought out about the fact that our current food system actually has enough food to feed the world, but yet we are unable to do that. Part of that reason is because the world's beef cattle consume calories equal to that which could feed 8.7 billion people on the planet. That's more than the entire population alive today. So the issue is really right now is we are reliant on this one system to provide us with protein that is largely inefficient. We are taking 100 calories from grain and converting that. By basically what I mean is we're feeding the grain that we grow to animals and then letting those animals grow and slaughter those animals and converting that into calories for humans. And what ends up happening in the process, we end up losing a lot of calories. So 100 calories from grain turns out to be only about 44 calories for milk and only 3 calories for beef. So the state we're in is we're relying on this inefficient system, and it's the only system we seem to have. And as countries around the world start to consume more meat and more dairy and more eggs, the strain that we're going to place on the planet is just going to magnify in the years ahead.
Mm. Another issue, too, is that I remember when I was in the Peace Corps many years ago, people would talk about America as a place where everybody could eat meat whenever they wanted to. Mm. And in a lot of the developing countries, there is a stigma to not having meat in your diet. Having meat is associated often with being middle class, upper middle class, and a lot of these American companies that are expanding so rapidly in these countries are taking advantage of that and letting people into this kind of social club where, yes, you too can have a hamburger every day. In America, I think we're going in a different direction, but as you point out, the rest of the world isn't.
Gene Stone is an acclaimed author who's written more than 45 books on a wide range of subjects. He's co-author of national bestsellers such as Forks Over Knives and How Not to Die. Neil Zacharias is co-founder of One Green Planet. It's an online platform focusing on things like animal welfare issues and cruelty-free living. Gene and Neil are co-authors of the new book, Eat for the Planet, Saving the World, One Bite at a Time. And on today's Your Calls One Planet series, we're talking with Gene and Neil about their new book and the incredible facts. Just a few. How much Americans eat annually? Beef? 54 pounds. It takes 1,800 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. And again, this is a really interesting fact that sometimes it's hard to figure out, well, how does that happen exactly? And we're going to talk about that. The average American eats 46 pounds of pork, and it takes 576 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of pork. By the year 2050, the world must feed about 10 billion people. We'll need, if we stay on this track, to produce more food in the next 40 years than was produced in the past 10,000 years. Now, this issue finally is getting attention among environmental groups. Over the weekend on Earth Day, I hope people talked about this issue. What are your thoughts? What questions do you have for our guests? How does climate change and our environmental crisis play into your diet? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And sometimes it's hard to really think about, well, 40% of our world's grain is fed to livestock while 1 billion people go to bed hungry every night. Can you break that down? I mean, if you have any questions specifically about how this really works on the ground, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. It's good to talk with you again. Welcome back. Okay. In the 70s, there was a book of Diet for a Small Planet talking about the complementariality of vegetable proteins and the fact that in that book, certain things, when combined together, have the same quality of protein equal to that of egg white, which is, so to speak, the gold standard. Then shifting over to the different topic relative to starvation, I don't believe it's changed since I learned about it, that the starvation rate on the global scale is 2%, and that includes America, and that 100,000 people per day don't wake up the next day. So with that scenario, it's like it would only take, if we traded a San Franciscan, that would take a week and we'd be a ghost tank. Anyway, it's nice that this has become an interwoven issue relative to the ecology, but a lot of times solutions have to be found that are relevant. For instance, in India, you can't use tractors on the subdivided plots, yet if a small engine with a cable and towing a plow through the hard dirt, that would work. So hopefully our creative minds will get to fruition on some of these challenges we're facing.
Well, thank you for that, Phil. So, Neil, when we're talking about solutions, obviously you want people to either eat less meat or none at all, dairy and eggs. Can you elaborate on this? Because things have really changed. There's a lot more awareness. There are a lot more options. Cost is definitely an issue, especially when we're talking about organic fruits and vegetables. You know, a lot of people who pick our fruits and vegetables here in California cannot afford to eat them. So that's a main issue.
Yeah, so if you think of the book, really, we lay out the case of why we need a better food system, but by no means, as Jean said earlier, are we just trying to scare people. The good news and the silver lining is that there are pretty simple solutions, and there is a lot of momentum towards that solution, especially in the last 5 or 6 years. So the area we talk a lot about, we mention it in the book as well, is that at an individual level, there's some simple things anyone can do. So first and foremost is moderate your consumption of animal protein. So cut down and eat once a week, maybe once a day if you're eating more than once a day. Find out whatever works for you. The first and most impactful step you can take is to cut down on your consumption of animal products. Now, the question that usually arises when people cut down is, what do I replace that with? And here's where I think things are starting to get very interesting, is that if you look at most of the items that people have at home in their pantries or their refrigerators, if you now go to grocery stores across the country, not just Whole Foods or small natural product stores, you can find one-to-one replacements for nearly every product. So let me give you some examples. If you're looking for a mayo, you can now buy mayo that's made without eggs, without dairy. You can find a plant-based butter. You can find burgers that are made from plants that bleed. You can literally find almost any product that can replace something you would use in your refrigerator, that you store in your refrigerator or your pantry. Any sort of packaged foods, from snacks to beverages, there are plant-based options out there that make it very easier. So the second step we recommend is people replace items that are easily replaceable, even if they don't want to completely cut out their consumption of animal products. And lastly, and I think this is the advice most, you know, there's a lot of controversy around what people should eat or shouldn't eat from a health standpoint. But there's one piece of advice that's always consistent, is eat more whole foods and fruits and vegetables. That's something I don't think any dietitian, whether you fall on one end of the spectrum when it comes to vegan eating or the other end of the spectrum which comes to paleo or ketogenic eating, everyone agrees that whole fruits and vegetables are good for you.
I would like to add, interesting, Phil brought up Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore-Lepay, which is in many ways a great book, but it had in that book a huge mistake. The author talked about how plants were not able to give you the essential amino acids that you needed. And a lot of people still believe that you can't get the right proteins from plants. The author herself actually realized that she'd made a mistake, and in the 10th anniversary edition of her book, she completely retracted the statement, said, you can indeed get all the protein you need from plants. That's not an issue. People still worry about that. But you really can get your entire healthy diet from a plant-based whole food diet, as Noh points out. And the other thing you brought up is the cost issue. If you were to Google eating cheaply on a plant-based diet, it's been several studies have shown that, if you end up eating organic fruits that come from high-end markets, yeah, that's really expensive. But you actually can eat much more inexpensively on a plant-based diet than you can on a agricultural meat, egg-based diet.
Jean Stone is an author who's written more than 45 books, including Forks Over Knives and How Not to Die. He is co-author with Neil Zacharias of Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. Neil Zacharias is co-founder of One Green Planet, an online platform focusing on sustainable food, animal issues, environmental protection, and cruelty-free living. And today we're talking about their book. Over the weekend, maybe you went to an Earth Day event. So many people were out this weekend cleaning up beaches, raising awareness about plastic pollution. Luckily, that one is now getting so much attention. And overall, just promoting and supporting environmental sustainability. And this issue, industrial factory farming, is now getting a lot more attention, and the role that our food production system and diet has on greenhouse gas emissions. Our food system contributes 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions, more than any other sector except energy production. This is Your Calls One Planet. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with Neil Zacharias and Gene Stone about their new book, Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. 99% of meat, dairy, and eggs available in the United States come from factory farms. If you have any questions or comments for Neil or Gene, we'd love to hear from you. This issue is starting now to get a lot more attention than even 5 years ago. So when you get your hands on this kind of information, how does it affect the food choices that you make? Our human population right now is 7.5 billion. Livestock population, 20 billion. 20 billion livestock. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. This is a fascinating and incredibly important topic, but I wanted to put a slightly different spin on what we're talking about, if I could. I've been looking at animals as a source of energy and a way of not only producing food, but also producing energy and preserving the water component. So the concept is to take the manure produced by the animals, which is massive quantities. There's about 45 kilos of manure produced per cow per day, for example, and turning that into energy using what's called anaerobic digestion. But in addition to doing the energy production from the animals, also by building a pond and doing what's called integrated farming, which I suspect your guests are aware of, you can make algae out of the CO2 being produced and the fertilizer being produced by the animals. This allows you at the same time to do aquaculture, and you can feed the algae back to the animals and put omega-3 into their meat or the milk or even the eggs. So by closing the loops on these systems, the farm animal or livestock agriculture, while it's not sustainable, becomes that much more sustainable. I'd really like to hear your guest comment on this concept of closing the loops on our livestock system by closing the loop between food, water, and energy. Oh, and let me just quickly say, the water component, the water from the anaerobic digester is filled with fertilizer, and if you use that water to grow the microalgae that use the carbon that you feed back to the aquaculture component in the pond where you're growing the algae, you can also make a hydroponic or an aquaponic system out of it and grow much higher concentrations of food per unit area because you can add aquaculture to farming in this closed-loop way.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. Gene or Neil, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to answer that. I mean, I think this is a very... Hi. This is a very interesting point that's been brought up. There's been developments both in terms of regenerative agriculture, which is doing animal farming that is done in a way that's more cohesive with how you should manage the soil. There's been some discussions, as the caller pointed out, on how you could turn the waste from our animal farming system and kind of in some ways create this closed loop system that would prevent these damaging outputs. But before I specifically answer that, it's for the listener, it's important for everyone to understand the scale of the animal waste system and the scale of in the industrial factory farming operations in the U.S. So in the U.S., we produce about 369 million tons of waste from the factory farming system every year. That's enough waste, and we have this in the book as well, that's enough waste to fill the Empire State Building every day of the year for an entire year. So that's a lot of waste. And what's happening today, as opposed to what the caller pointed out, is most of this waste, some of it gets converted into fertilizer, most of that ends up in these open cesspools where, you know, they end up leaking into our rivers and waterways. Just last year, some research came out about Tyson Foods, which found that they had dumped over 104 million tons of animal waste into our rivers and waterways between the period of 2010 to 2014. So that's the scale of what is happening right now in this country and increasingly around the world.
And Neil, can I just add, this is also an environmental justice issue because the film Speciesism has drone footage of a Smithfield pig farm in North Carolina. And it is a cesspool of manure. And sadly, people of color live near this cesspool, and they are smelling the stuff, they're breathing this manure, and they're having health issues as a result. I mean, a lot of these slaughterhouses are located in places near poor communities and communities of color, and they have to bear the brunt of the health effects of these factory farms.
You're absolutely right, and there have been a lot of research on what happens to neighborhood near these farms. And as you point out, they tend to become impoverished because nobody wants to live next to these things. It's not just the smell, it's the odors, but it's also the sicknesses that the airborne sicknesses that result too.
Right.
So you're totally right. This is an issue. Like all of these issues, it's all interconnected. You can't just simply look at food or just look at water. The unfortunate issue is that you really have to enlarge your mind and look at all of these issues at once to see their interconnectedness.
Well, and can you, so Jonathan's idea sounds great. And if you're talking about maybe a farm in Point Reyes, that could work. But as you point out, 99% of the meat, dairy, and eggs is at a factory farm. I mean, can you just let people know the scale of these farms and how it's changed? Because we're not talking about mom and pop farms in, you know, Sonoma County anymore. I grew up in Petaluma. We used to have a ton of egg farms, all kinds of farms, and it's changed a lot since then, over the last 40 years.
I think you bring up a very important point, and I think I don't want to ignore Jonathan's question, which is often when people hear about the scale of factory farming and they find out that, you know, 99% of all the meat, dairy, eggs we consume in this country is coming from these terrible factories, which in fact are not good for the environment, terrible for the animals involved, and not good for the communities surrounding those farms either. So the first thing they tend to turn to is how can we solve the problem? And there are several solutions. I pointed regenerative agriculture. A lot of people are turning to bring back the sort of a long-storied vision of an idyllic farm with grazing cows and a red barn. But the reality is you can find solutions. You can find better ways to do animal farming from a sustainability standpoint. I'm not going to say that there aren't any. There are. You can do it in a way that has less of an impact on the surrounding environment. In fact, significantly less than what is happening with factory farms. But the reality is, if we continue consuming meat, eggs, and dairy at the rate at which we currently consume, there's no way we can feed the world, even if we find a better way to do it. So even if you have found an idyllic farm that has learned how to create a closed-loop system, that has learned how to reuse the water, the question is, can we feed the world? Now, you can feed small populations of people, and perhaps that is a solution for some people who can afford to buy those animal products. But the reason we wrote this book is we want people to take a step back and look at what's happening globally and look at what is going to happen in the next 30 years, and that if we don't think globally, we're going to be in a significantly bad place 30 years from now in 2050. And these small solutions won't help if everyone doesn't recognize that we need to reduce our consumption.
Yeah, it's very true what Nils says, and going back to Jonathan's point, what he's talking about is wonderful, but it's really not going to drive the enormous profits that these food companies make, and that is their bottom line. They're not really interested in the environment. They're interested in their stakeholders making the money they need to from their investments. So, unfortunately, you're running here headlong into capitalism, which is not necessarily environmentally friendly.
Mm. Gene Stone and Nils Zacharias are co-authors of Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. Thank you for calling, Jonathan. Let's go next to Lorraine in Brisbane. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hey, Mike. I think it's important to reduce the animal protein that we eat, of course. But my concern is that a lot of the replacement products are soy-based. And there's been a lot of concern and debate over genetically modified organisms, and that the soy crop is primarily in the United States GMO soy. So I wondered if
Yeah.
To bring that into the conversation.
I mean, I've been plant-based for 23 years and I don't eat any soy. Or I try to avoid GMO, obviously can't avoid it altogether. But what are your thoughts about soy, Neil or Gene?
First and foremost, I think you have to understand the reason why soy is largely genetically modified, and the soy that you get in the U.S. is genetically modified. Soy is 47% of soy that we produce is fed to cattle. Mm-hmm. So soy production is very tied into the animal agriculture system. I'm not going to comment from a health standpoint about soy, but if you are concerned about soy, and I know there's some debate about whether it's good for your health or bad, even if you consume organic soy, there are luckily other forms of protein out there from the plant kingdom. In fact, if you, and here's again back to the silver lining I kind of alluded to earlier, if you look at what's happening right now in the food industry, there is a massive shift away from this industrial animal agriculture system. It's just the early stages of it. So a few stats, if you don't mind, but I think it's important for everyone to understand this, what's happening right now. 17% of Americans age 15 to 70 say that they eat a predominantly plant-based diet. And 60% of them say that they're cutting down on their meat consumption. And about 36% of people claim that they are eating plant-based meats. Now, the caller brings up an important point. Is, are plant-based meats better? Or are they worse for you when compared to animal protein? And I think the good news is that a lot of the new products and new companies that have emerged in the past 5 or 6 years are aware of the concerns around or the concerns people tend to have around soy. So a lot of the new plant-based meats tend to be made out of pea protein. In fact, a lot of them are soy-free. And increasingly, you're seeing new research coming out of both universities as well as some of these new companies that are looking into other forms of plant protein. Unfortunately, and this kind of ties back to another bigger problem with this whole food system of ours, is that the animal agriculture system has been heavily subsidized by our tax dollars. So $38 billion go into farm animal subsidies that largely subsidize commodity crops like soy and corn and subsidize animal farming operations. And because of that, we've not had enough government dollars flowing into research into things like plant proteins, like specialty crops like pea and lucerne and others that may be able to offer very animal protein-like or meat-like experiences from a taste and texture standpoint. Hmm. So the good news is there is some work happening. It's happening at the startup level of food companies. And again, we talked a little bit about Tyson, about capitalism. I think the good news there, too, is that companies like Tyson Foods, who are one of the biggest meat processors, producers in the world, even they are recognizing that they're no longer thinking of their meat divisions as meat divisions. They're calling them protein divisions. In fact, Tyson is one of the early investors in a startup that is producing plant-based meat. So there are several options out there. I would encourage the caller to investigate soy-free options if soy is a concern. And of course, look into the health information. I'm sure Gene can add a lot more there since he's written a few books on that topic.
Rose, I'm actually glad you said what you said. A lot of people do feel that if they're going to go plant-based, that means all they're going to be eating is soy. But like you, I seldom have soy. I might have tempeh, which is fermented, and many people feel health-wise that's better for you. But what we're really asking people to do, if they're interested in a plant-based diet, is to consider a plant-based whole food diet, which really means vegetables, fruits, legumes, and whole grains.
Well, thank you, Lorraine. If you need any resources, please email us, and I'll send you a few. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Aaron in Oakland. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Let's talk about cow's milk for a minute. That's still one of the animal products that I consume the most of. I thought that during California's recent extreme drought in the last few years, that I had heard or read that almond milk, for example, had an even higher water footprint than cow's milk. So I wonder if you could talk about that research and just compare some of the alternative milks and cow's milk in terms of environmental.
Thank you. Let's do both things. Let's talk about the water that is used for dairy, and then we'll talk about almonds. As you write in your book, Eat for the Planet, like corn and soy, alfalfa is a very water-intensive crop. Producing 1 pound requires 114 gallons of water. Neil, why don't you talk about what you learned about water and dairy?
Yeah, so you're right to point out 98% of dairy's water footprint comes from feed, which is alfalfa, as you just mentioned. So it's a very water-intensive crop. But by no means is the feed for dairy cows the only cause for concern when it comes to water. You also, the cows consume a lot of water for hydration purposes. Milking puts a huge metabolic strain on dairy cows, so they need to hydrate. And on top of that, you need to have water be used to keep the milking parlor somewhat sanitary. So you have these automated flushing systems that are constantly putting water into the floors of these factory farms where dairy cows are milked. So that all adds up to a lot of water per cow. And so 1 gallon of milk uses about 2,000 gallons of water, which is not small by any means. That's nearly the amount of water you would use to shower for the entire month. Now, the caller brings up almond milk, and it's important. I'm glad that he also asked about other options that exist out there. Again, another misconception is if you're switching from dairy, the only other option is soy milk, and we discussed soy earlier, or almond milk. Luckily, that's not the case anymore. And the reason, firstly, almonds are also a water-intensive crop, definitely not as much as dairy, and especially when you're talking about California, California produces about 80% of the world's almonds. So a lot of the strain when it comes to water tends to be in California because California is a huge producer. Are there other options out there? Undoubtedly, they are. In fact, in the last few years, we've seen the emergence of plant-based milks that are beyond just almond milk. Now, undoubtedly, almond is the most popular right now, but you can also get milk that's made from peas. You can get blends of coconut and other milk. There's oat milk that is increasingly more popular, especially when it comes to using it as a creamer in coffee. I would urge the caller to walk into a grocery store and explore a few other options in terms of taste. And also look into whether you can find an almond-free option if almonds are cause for concern.
Hemp milk is also a good alternative if you're concerned about water. And Jean, isn't it true that there's a major difference between water usage and conventional almonds and organic almonds? So almonds in the desert use far more water than almonds that are grown up north, for example.
I actually don't know that. That's good to know. I do know that almond milk has gotten this bad rap, and there's no question that it is water intensive, but of course there are other issues in terms of not just water, but the entirety of the cycle of meat production versus a tree and an almond. But as Neil points out, there are so many other milks available, and a lot of people I know are now talking about milks made out of peas, which are better for the world, both in terms of a water and a carbon basis. And pea milk takes about 85% less water to grow than almonds. So I would urge people to think carefully about what kind of substitute milk they want. But of course, what most people are going to do is look for taste. And what it really comes down to, I think, unfortunately, is that is what defines most people's decision with food. So we would urge certain people to stop drinking dairy milk, but then look into all the many, many options: oat milk, rice milk, hazelnut milk, pea milk, almond milk, etc., and make a wise choice.
All right. Well, thank you for that phone call. We have an email from Emily. She says, much of the environmental movement seems to be placed on individual actions rather than mass movements, playing into the capitalist idea of voting with your dollar. How do we shift our food consumption from individual actions to a mass movement? Neil, do you want to take that first?
Great question. I've thought a lot about this actually, because when I first got interested in food and the environment and how the food that I was putting on my plate was connected to the destruction of the world around us and harming future generations on this planet, I wondered what was the best way to solve it. And like most people, I kept wondering why the government wasn't doing something about this. Why can't we have some sort of a mass movement to change this? And the more I thought about it, here's where I've concluded on the subject, is that it starts with the individual. And I've seen facts emerge in the last 5 years that confirm that. First and foremost, if you get people to recognize that the food choice that they're making 3 or more times a day has more of an environmental impact than almost any other choice that they make. Of course, you can minimize your environmental impact doing other things, but if you can change the way you eat, you can automatically make a huge difference. Now, the good news is more people have started to recognize that. So the individual demand for replacements to meat and dairy and eggs is what's given rise to so many options when it comes to plant-based foods. So I think of it as sort of a chain reaction. And I think that individuals at the end of the day have much more power than they actually think they do. And if you firstly change the way you consume, you're going to increase demand. It's basic economics. If more people demand cleaner, better, healthier, more sustainable foods, then the industry will respond. And what we've seen in the last 5 years is that's exactly what's happened. Is not just, as I said, Tyson as well, which is a meat producer, is starting to see why they need to change the way they produce food and look to plant proteins. There's also been this emergence of new companies that are looking to solve the problem because they know, thanks to more information out there, more consumers are demanding better. So the industry changes. And I know we mentioned capitalism, but that's the system that we have today. It's not perfect, but if we want to bring about change, this is where I've concluded on the matter. If we want to bring about change in the most efficient manner, we have to work within that system to improve it. So if the industry changes and the industry starts to see that there's more money to be made selling sustainable plant-based foods as people shift away from meat and dairy and eggs, then before you know it, you're going to have a very strong and profitable food industry that is predominantly plant-based, that can then exert the kind of power we need on government to change policies. It's a natural chain reaction because thanks to capitalism, policies go where the money goes. The money goes where people's choices go when it comes to their consumption habits and how they spend their dollars. So while it may look on the surface, we're putting all the pressure on individuals to change and being that starting point, but I think individuals need to be think of themselves as the spark for this much broader movement, and that, you know, we can't only focus on individual choices. We also have to reform the industry and encourage them to produce better products, and simultaneously we have to lobby our government to shift some of these subsidies to more research and to more efforts to encourage companies that are producing sustainable food to do a better job. That's how I think we can maybe bring about a movement. But again, we have more power than we think we do.
Gene, what would you add?
Well, it is a terrific question. It's one that people have been asking forever. And I agree with everything Neil said. Mass movements only exist when individuals make those changes and demand as a group that they occur. So what I would say is the way you transform individual actions into mass actions is by everybody doing it, everyone agreeing. And frankly, that's why we wrote the book, is to try to stir up individuals to come together and create a mass movement to eat for the planet.
I wanted to ask you quickly, when we're talking about government action, we can't end the show without talking about the Trump administration and how they are rolling back animal welfare regulations for organic farms, for example. Mother Jones has a piece about how they want to make pork processing much faster and more dangerous for workers in slaughterhouses. In a typical pork slaughterhouse, pigs move down the conveyor belt at an average rate of 977 an hour. That is about 16 a minute, and they want to speed that up. How do you think, Neil, people can stand up against these changes?
You know, it's a tough problem. It's a tough question in that sense, because we have to speak up. We can't just say, well, I'm going to vote with my dollars and I'm not going to care about what policies are being enacted. So I would encourage people to use the power that they have when it comes to writing to their state legislative representatives so that they can put pressure and improve the policies that are being proposed out there. Is that by any means the most effective? Probably not, but you have to try. So I believe you have to do everything that you can to speak up when something is unjust. But at the same time, you have to recognize that we can wait for policies to change, or we can start being, I know it's a bit cliched, but we can start being the change ourselves. So I would encourage everyone to do their part first. And then once that's done, you can collectively have a much bigger voice and a much more consistent voice lobbying your lawmakers to do the right thing when it comes to farming practices.
Gene?
Well, I think that the one good thing I've seen about the Trump administration is it's encouraged many people who were politically inactive or just didn't seem to care to come out and actually become involved. Elections really matter. They matter for you, your family, for animals, for the planet, for everything. And people have to understand that. They have to become involved. They have to vote. And they can make a better world if they participate.
We've got a couple questions from listeners. We're almost out of time about population. Mark writes, these are great ideas, but why is nothing being done to humanely prevent 10 billion people? Again, by the year 2050, the world must feed about 10 billion people. Just quickly, Neil, doing this research, how did it affect you or change the way you think about population growth?
Yeah, that's a great point. We usually get that question often. I think that population growth is unstoppable at this point, and we're eventually going to plateau around 2050 or 2060. That's just the nature of the world that we live in. While I applaud people who think that's something we need to focus on, I think because of increased lifespan, better innovations around health, which are all good for humanity, we really can't tackle the problem by curbing population. We have to address the bigger problem, which is how do we sustain this growing population on a planet with finite resources? And how do we make sure we're not extracting resources faster than those resources are able to replenish themselves? And that's just basic ecology. And that's basic ecosystems, how they run. And I think we need to start becoming more ecocentric in that sense. And the only way to do that is to make the systemic change in our food system that we're proposing.
Well, we got a few questions about population growth, so we will definitely do a show about that in the future. We also got a number of questions about recipes. You can go to onegreenplanet.org. They've got incredible information there and a lot of recipes. I think you'll enjoy that website. Neil Zacharias is co-founder of One Green Planet. He and Gene Stone are co-authors of the new book, Eat for the Planet, Saving the World One Bite at a Time. Neil and Gene, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. You can sign up for our podcast, yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.